Are you limping when you could be walking strong? Whimpering when you could be whistling? Crying when you could be laughing? Are you being defeated by your problems? Facing frustrations that are discouraging you? Heartaches that are depressing you? Are you bored with life? Tired of living? Lacking zest and excitement? Are you watching somebody make a great success of an opportunity you turned down? Are your projects and dreams struggling when they could be thriving, shrinking when they could be growing, failing when they could be succeeding? Then, capital letters, this is for you. This, italics, is your chance to change your thinking and to change your life. Some of you may have heard that little quote before from my lips. It's not one of those adverts for health foods or vitamin pills. It's actually chapter one of a book that invites you to move ahead with possibility thinking. Let me read you a little more of the advice it offers. Repeat out loud these powerful affirmations. I'm going to be happy today. Though the skies are cloudy and grey, no matter what comes my way, I'm going to be happy today. I am happy. I really am happy. I can do great things. I have great possibilities deep inside me. You'll feel like a braggart and a liar, advises the author. But read them out. And then repeat them again, louder. Try this prayer three times every morning. I believe, I believe, I believe. This kind of prayer really flushes the negatives out of the brain. Now repeat, I can, I can, I can. Well, it's not really my intention to pour scorn on books of that sort, much as they may invite it. People are genuinely helped by books like that, and in fact the author of that particular paperback I just quoted has an extremely large church in California to prove it. But I do have a little problem when he suggests that reciting, I believe, I believe, is a prayer. I believe in what? I'm tempted to ask. Judging from the repeated use of the pronoun I that characterizes the book, one can't escape the suspicion the author is really advising his readers to believe in themselves. And that isn't prayer, it's psychotherapy. That isn't faith, it's self-hypnosis. That isn't Christianity, actually. It's humanism. Most important of all, that isn't a recipe for success. It's a recipe for disaster. Long ago, Solomon in his wisdom wrote, "Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall." And believing in yourself is really what pride and a haughty spirit is all about. This morning we're going to study two examples to prove it. Not just two individuals, but two corporate examples, two nations, which believed in themselves and who were led by that megalomaniac self-confidence to ruin. You'll find them both in the study passage we're going to look at. The first is Israel, which is dealt with in that part of the reading we didn't actually read out just now, from verse 8 to chapter 10, verse 4. 9, verse 8 to 10, verse 4. That's an example of the kind of pride that refuses to seek God's help in a situation of human despair. The second example is Assyria, which we did read about from 10 verse 5 to 10 verse 19. That's an example of the kind of pride that refuses to acknowledge God's help in a situation of human success. Put them together, and you will know the truth of the proverb. Pride comes before a fall. Let's start with Israel. The pride that refuses to seek God's help in a situation of human despair. Look at verses 8 to 10 of Isaiah chapter 9. The Lord has sent a message against Jacob. It will fall on Israel. All the people will know it. Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria, who say with pride and arrogance of heart, the bricks have fallen down, but we will rebuild with dressed stone. The fig trees have been felled, but we will replace them with cedars. Now those of you who have been following this series will remember, I hope, the historical background to these chapters. Assyria, under its brilliant general Tiglath-Pileser III, remember him? He has unleashed the military might of the Assyrian army upon the Middle East with the ambition of bringing the whole area under his imperial rule. Some countries, like tiny Judah, where Isaiah lived, have tried to buy immunity from assault by paying protection money to Assyria. Others, though, have decided upon a more aggressive policy. In particular, Israel, the country these particular verses are addressing, under its leader King Pekah, and Syria, under its leader King Rezin, remember those two names from last week? They have formed an alliance to resist the Assyrian advance. Well, as Isaiah predicted in our study last week, their alliance didn't succeed. We know from both biblical accounts in 2 Kings and from Assyrian inscriptions that archaeologists have found that sometime around 733 BC, the Assyrian army moved west in response to this challenge from the Israelite-Syrian alliance. It occupied Syria, the first country it came to, completely, executing King Rezin, ravaging his capital city of Damascus, and deporting a very large proportion of the Syrian population to prevent further rebellion. As for Israel, well, she suffered too as a result of that punitive campaign. In 2 Kings 15, we are told that a large part of Israelite territory was overrun by the Assyrian army, that numerous cities were destroyed, and some of their population too was taken into exile. But Israel was just a little luckier than Syria. Her capital city, Samaria, was spared. Largely, it seems, because the luckless King Pekah was assassinated in a palace coup just in the nick of time. And a political opportunist called Hoshea took the throne in his stead and no doubt sent urgent messages to the advancing Assyrian army that the regime had changed, everything would be all right now, Tiglath-Pileser, I will be a faithful vassal of the Assyrians and pay my taxes on time. So Israel, though severely damaged by this Assyrian invasion, managed by the skin of its teeth to survive the crisis. And this prophecy of Isaiah in chapter 9 is reflecting the kind of attitudes that prevailed in that northern kingdom in the aftermath of the Assyrian army's withdrawal. Now you might have expected that the Israelite population would be feeling a little cowed by their recent experiences, wouldn't you? I mean, their army had been routed, their allies had been devastated, their territory overrun. They'd avoided total annihilation by the narrowest of escapes. One would have thought these things might have engendered some sense of mild humiliation in the country. But Isaiah's reading of the national mood is quite different. See what he says in verse 10? The bricks have fallen down, but we will rebuild. The fig trees have been felled, but we will replace them. They demonstrated, in other words, a blasé dismissiveness regarding the defeat they suffered. Oh, the economy will soon pick up, they said. The Assyrian army's done us a favour, really, knocking down all those old cheap brick-built houses and burning those rather unproductive fig trees. I mean, now we can reconstruct with the best quality stone and the best quality cedar. Now, it's not hard to imagine the kind of media release that was emerging from King Hoshea's palace press office. No cause for public anxiety. The government has the situation fully in hand. In a few years' time, Israel will be more prosperous than ever. Indeed, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if King Hoshea wasn't one of those possibility thinkers, whose reaction when faced with, quote, frustrations that discouraged him and heartaches that depressed him, was to stand in front of a mirror and flush the negatives out of his brain by repeating, I believe, I believe, I believe, I can, I can, I can. But you see, even if he called that kind of sanguine optimism faith, Isaiah the prophet did not. The Lord has sent a message against Jacob. It will fall on Israel. Everybody will know it. Everybody in Samaria who say with pride and arrogance of heart, the bricks have fallen down, but we will rebuild. Pride, then. That was the prophet's verdict on this attitude of breezy self-confidence in Samaria. Pride that failed to acknowledge the hand of God's judgment in what had happened, and that was refusing to seek God's help in this dreadful situation of devastation. See what he says in verse 13? The people have not returned to him who struck them. They have not sought the Lord Almighty. Don't you realize he's saying in these verses, it's the Lord who gives foreign armies their victory over you. Today in the 8th century BC, it's the Assyrian army under Tiglath-Pileser. A century ago, it was the Syrians, your allies, the Arameans, under their king Ben-Hadad. Before that, it was the Philistines. But every time, the story is the same. It is the Lord, verse 11, that has strengthened reason's foes against them and has spurred their enemies on, Arameans from the east, Philistines from the west, who have devoured Israel with an open mouth. It's the Lord who does these things. These military invasions, past and present, they're ways of God rebuking you, he's saying, for your foolish alliance with pagans and for your failure to honor him. These things are signs of his anger. And I tell you, says Isaiah, that divine anger has not been appeased yet. Verse 12. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. You're not over the worst yet, Israel. For God is looking for repentance. He's looking for some evidence that you've learned the folly of believing in yourself and that you are beginning to trust him again. But no such luck. Israel hadn't profited from the lesson this Assyrian invasion was meant to teach her in the least. This complacency she was demonstrating in the face of failure and defeat simply proved how proud and haughty she was. And make no mistake about it, says Isaiah, pride comes before destruction. A haughty spirit before a fall. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. What follows, you see, from verse 13 onwards, is a series of four-verse stanzas, just like the one we've just looked at from verse 8 to 12. Each stanza is describing a different aspect of the judgment that was still bound to come upon a nation like Israel, because she was so entrenched in this arrogant self-confidence, this confidence in her own ability to cope. And each of those stanzas, you'll notice, ends with that same grim chorus about his anger not being turned away. Let's quickly run through them together. First is the one from verse 13 to 17. But the people have not returned to him who struck them, nor have they sought the Lord Almighty. So the Lord will cut off from Israel both head and tail, both palm branch and reed, in a single day. The elders and prominent men are the head. The prophets who teach lies are the tail. Those who guide this people mislead them, and those who are guided are led astray. Therefore the Lord will take no pleasure in the young men, nor will he pity the fatherless and the widows. For everyone is ungodly and wicked. Every mouth speaks vileness. Yet for all this his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. Cutting off the head and tail, of course, is what you do to a carcass before you roast it on a spit. And says Isaiah, that's what God plans to do to this proud nation. The head represents the government, the elders and prominent men, as he calls them in verse 15. These were the people, he says, who were feeding the suicidal nationalist pride of Israel with their smooth propaganda. And the tail, he says, well, that represents the false prophets, the professional clergy employed as political advisers to the royal court, but who really preached whatever lies the government paymaster told them to preach. These were the people Israel was listening to, he says. These were the people she was putting her confidence in. Instead of leading her to penitence and to depend on the Lord Almighty, all this recent national emergency had resulted in was that she invested even more reliance in her politicians and in her civil service. That says Isaiah, these national leaders are about as dependable as a frond on a palm tree or a reed of the riverbed. They're seducing you into false confidence by their bland assurances and their optimistic communiques. No, it's godlessness and corruption that they ought to be addressing if they really wanted to build a secure future for this country. But those moral issues aren't being tackled at all. If anything, the moral fiber of the nation, he says, is getting weaker and weaker by the day. So we come to our next stanza in verse 18. Surely wickedness burns like a fire. It consumes briars and thorns. It sets the forest thickets ablaze so that it rolls upward in a column of smoke. By the wrath of the Lord Almighty, the land will be scorched, and the people will be fuel for the fire. No one will spare his brother. On the right they will devour, but they still be hungry. On the left they will eat, but not be satisfied. Each will feed on the flesh of his own offspring. Manasseh will feed on Ephraim, Ephraim on Manasseh, and together they will turn against Judah. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. If you look carefully, you'll see Isaiah is using the metaphor of fire here in two distinct ways. He's first of all using fire as a picture of the wickedness of Israel, a wickedness which he says has escalated from an insignificant beginnings to a roaring inferno that cloaks the whole landscape in its pall of smoke, verse 18. But secondly, he uses the picture of fire as a picture of the wrath of God, which he says will fall upon Israel precisely because of this sin of theirs, consuming both land and people in its retribution. It would be a mistake, I think, to interpret this double significance of fire as indicating some confusion in the prophet's mind, because, you see, there is a real sense in which these two fires are not two, but one. Paul makes very plain in the New Testament that, as often as not, God doesn't have to do anything positive in order to bring judgment on a sinful society. All he has to do is to abandon it to the consequences of its own moral decadence. And that seems to be Isaiah's thought here too. They will reap what they sow. The fire of wickedness will consume them. The greed and selfishness of this people, this remorseless self-indulgence, hungry, devouring but still hungry, eating but never satisfied, he says. It will sow the seeds of their own destruction. They will tear one another apart, he says, with their internecine feuds, coup and counter-coup, plot and counter-plot. The tribe of Manasseh vying with the tribe of Ephraim, he says, for control of the country. It'll be the law of the jungle. Every man for himself, look after number one. Do others before they do you. The only time they'll make peace with one another, he says, in order to engage in joint assault on the southern sister of Judah, as Judah had just experienced. Now, God wouldn't need to punish sin in a tinder box like Israel. All he had to do would be to stand back and watch the sparks of her own wickedness ignite the furnace of her own judgment. And in the resulting conflagration, he says, one group of citizens would get their fingers particularly badly burned. And that brings us to his last stanza, chapter 10. Woe to those who make unjust laws, to those who issue oppressive decrees, to deprive the poor of their rights and rob my oppressed people of justice. making widows their prey and robbing the fatherless. What will you do on the day of reckoning when disaster comes from afar? To whom will you run for help? Where will you leave your riches? Nothing will remain but to cringe among the captives or fall among the slain. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. Some of you, I'm sure, will be aware that for all the Old Testament prophets, social injustice was the final straw. It was the thing that broke God's patience, the thing that made judgment inevitable. So long as the courts could be relied upon to protect vulnerable members of society, so long as the government could be relied upon to uphold human rights in its legislation, why then there was hope. There was a beacon of righteousness in the land which God couldn't ignore. But in Israel in the 8th century BC, both judges and politicians were corrupt to the core, he tells us. The law had become an instrument of injustice and exploitation. Both judiciary and parliament functioned to victimize, he says, rather than to protect the weak. The powerful were just feathering their own nests at the expense of the poor, and nobody was taking a blind bit of notice. Well, says Isaiah, when the day comes, the day of judgment, you wealthy plutocrats in Samaria will be the one who feel the blow most fiercely. For your fat bank accounts won't be any comfort to you. You won't be able to buy immunity from God's judgment the way you tried to buy immunity from Assyrian invasion. You won't have any heirs to bequeath it all to either. For like everybody else, rich or poor, you will either be in the concentration camp or the cemetery. Nothing will remain but to cringe among the captives or fall among the slain. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. It's a frightful chorus, that, isn't it? Relentlessly driving home by its fourfold repetition in this passage the inevitability, the persistence, the inescapability of God's wrath against sin. Now, of course, none of us like to think about that, do we? We prefer to imagine God as a kindly old benefactor whose only interest is, like Santa Claus, to give us good things to enjoy. We don't like to think about judgment. We don't like to think about hell. But I suggest to you, whether we like it or not, Isaiah this morning is forcing us to consider these things. He's asking us a question. He's asking, how do we react to the bad things that happen to us? The defeats, the failures, the disappointments, the tragedies. Are we the sort of people, he asks, who, like Israel, think it's a sign of weakness to cry out to God in a situation like that? Are we the sort of possibility thinker who believes in himself, whose reaction to trouble is to repeat out loud powerful affirmations like, I'm going to be happy today. Though the skies are cloudy and grey, whatever comes my way, I'm going to be happy today. Is that our philosophy? Believe in yourself. Draw on your own resources. Like the Stoic, a stiff upper lip. Like the poet Henley, in the fell clutch of circumstance. I have not winced or cried aloud beneath the bludgeonings of chance. My head is bloody but unbowed. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. It sounds courageous. It can even be made to sound vaguely Christian. But the fact is, like Israel, such defiant self-assertion is not faith at all. It is presumption. Of it, God says, the Lord has sent a message against Jacob. All who say with pride and arrogance of heart, the bricks have fallen down, but we will rebuild. The fig trees have been felled, but we will replace them. You see? It isn't fate, it is God who brings tragedy and defeat into our lives. He does not do so maliciously, he does so as part of his sovereign purpose. His purpose is to bring us to a sense of personal dependence on him. He's far more interested that we should be spiritually well than that we should be materially prosperous. Faith, then, in a situation of human despair or loss or disappointment or failure does not mean screwing yourself up psychologically till you've convinced yourself, I can cope. That isn't faith. Faith is the very opposite of that. Faith means, like verse 13 says, returning to the one who struck us. Seeking the Lord Almighty. Faith in such a situation means accepting my inadequacy, acknowledging my guilt, admitting my failure. And in the face of that humiliation of our egos, seeking the face of God, whose mercy and grace alone can bring us through the crisis. Refusing to seek God's help in such a situation isn't laudable self-reliance. It's pride. And pride comes before a fall. And pride comes before a fall. Beware then of the prayer, I can, I can, I can. God is looking for those who will turn their eyes to heaven and say, you can. Oh, but maybe your response to that is, well, that's very nice, Roy, for those it applies to, but I'm not feeling defeated this morning. No, not in the least. I'm not a failure. No, I'm doing quite well, thank you very much. Well, if that's so, maybe you represent the other kind of self-confidence Isaiah wants to talk to us about this morning. The self-confidence, the pride that is represented not by Israel so much as by Assyria. The pride that will not acknowledge God's help in a situation of human success. Let's turn to that now in 10 verse 5. Woe to the Assyrian, the rod of my anger, in whose hand is the club of my wrath. I send him against a godless nation. I dispatch him against the people who anger me. But this is not what he intends. This is not what he has in mind. Are not my commanders all kings, he says? Shall I not deal with Jerusalem and her images as I dealt with Samaria and her idols? Now, when the Lord has finished all his work against Mount Zion and Jerusalem, he will say, I will punish the king of Assyria for the willful pride of his heart and the haughty look in his eyes. It's interesting, isn't it, to note that that word woe occurs both at the beginning of verse 5 and at the beginning of verse 1. I think it's a kind of subtle way of indicating that though the situation of Assyria and Israel were totally opposite, the one being the undisputed victor, the other being the humiliated loser, yet in God's eyes, the spiritual condition of these two places was remarkably similar. And therefore their fate would ultimately be the same. Woe to you both, he said. A plague on both your houses, Israel or Assyria. You are both arrogant. The one arrogant in defeat, the other arrogant in victory. What Isaiah is doing in these verses from 5 onwards is showing us the Assyrian conquest of the Middle East from two different perspectives. First, from the perspective of heaven, and then from the perspective of the Assyrian army itself. Heaven's perspective, you see, is quite simple in verses 5 and 6. Assyria, we're told here, is an instrument of discipline in God's hand, like a cane in the headmaster's study. The rod of his anger, he says, the club of his wrath. Do you notice that emphatic divine ego in verse 6? I send him against a godless nation. I dispatch him against the people who anger me to seize, loot, and snatch plunder. So Assyria is God's messenger boy. Her success in battle and conquest was solely due to the fact that God purposed to punish other nations, and in particular Israel, through her agency. In fact, there's a rather poignant irony in that adjective in verse 6, godless. Do you notice that? I send him against a godless nation. Because, of course, godless is a word Israel would normally apply to pagan people like Assyria. But such was the moral corruption within Israel that God could no longer see any distinction between her and her pagan neighbors. She was the godless nation now, and she must therefore bear the consequences of that godlessness. For unlike the gods of pagan countries, the Lord God of Israel was no patron deity, no puppet. Israel may have been his chosen nation, but she did not for that reason enjoy partiality when it came to judgment. On the contrary, God's justice was applied with even more rigor in her case, precisely because her spiritual privilege made her sin all the more culpable. She should have known better. It's a very important lesson for us, of course, in Western society. For some of us, perhaps, are tempted to pride ourselves on the fact that we are the heirs of Christian civilization. Our culture has been shaped by the Bible more than any other part of the world. And sometimes I think there's a tacit assumption in us that, this gives us an unquestioned right to be top of the international league table. It isn't so. When God evaluates the nations, he doesn't count church spires. He doesn't even count church attenders. He looks for righteousness. If he sees a godless nation, then the privilege of our religious heritage, far from mitigating his judgment, is likely simply to intensify it. We ought not to forget, you know, that we have a superpower to our east, just as Israel had a superpower to her east. And there's absolutely no reason why God should not use it as the rod of his anger, the club of his wrath against us, if the wickedness of our society deserves it. There is no favoritism with God. That then is heaven's perspective on Assyria's victory. She had won because God had enabled her to win. It was as simple as that. But you see, the Assyrian perspective on her victories was quite different from that. This is not what he intends, or as we might say, this is not how he interprets it, how the Assyrian interprets it. This is not what he has in mind, no. His purpose is to destroy, to put an end to many nations. Are not my commanders all kings, he says? Has not Calno fared like Carchemish? Is not Hamath like Arpad and Samaria like Damascus? Shall I not deal with Jerusalem and her images as I dealt with Samaria and her idols? It's a graphic soliloquy here in which Isaiah pictures the strutting conceit of this pagan emperor, Tiglath-Pileser. It never occurs to him that he's simply the tool of divine justice. He has no awareness either of the fact that he's being used by God or of his accountability to God, so he says. On the contrary, international conquest is his goal. Military power is his obsession. Why, he says, my generals are so mighty, each of them is a monarch in his own right. He recites the remorseless tide of victories they had won for him as the army of Assyria swept across the Middle East, dominating one small kingdom after another in its wake. Contemptuously, he catalogues their list of campaigns, Carchemish, Calno, Arpad, Hamath, Damascus, and of course, most recently, Samaria. And when I want to, he says, I'll take Jerusalem too. Of course I will. Why should that be any problem to me? Because it is the city of God. All these other cities had gods too. More gods, in fact. I've given up fearing the gods of the nations. Now, Jerusalem's images will present no more obstacle to the advance of my troops than did the images of all these other countries. Now, if anybody deserves to be called a god around here, I do. Look at verse 13. By the strength of my hand I have done this, and by my wisdom, because I have understanding, I removed the boundaries of nations. I plundered their treasures like a mighty one. That can be a title for God in the Old Testament. Like a mighty one, I subdued their king. Not much subtlety about his megalomania, is there? My strength, my wisdom, my understanding. He brags like some swaggering bully in the playground. Why, he says, it was all just like taking candy from a baby. Verse 14, as one reaches into a nest, so my hand reached for the wealth of the nations. As men gather abandoned eggs, so I gathered all the countries. Not one flapped a wing or opened its mouth to chirp. The contempt. Israel was too proud to ask God for help. That was perilous enough. But Assyria's pride was one degree higher than that. She wouldn't recognize God's help in her success. She wanted to take credit for it all. She didn't just want victory, she wanted glory. And that's why Isaiah is so sure she would be brought down. For the truth was that she was simply an instrument of God's anger. And once he'd finished the job he was using her for, it would be her turn to face judgment. I will punish the king of Assyria for the willful pride of his heart and the haughty look in his eyes. Does the axe raise itself above him who swings it? Or the sword boast against him who uses it? Therefore the Lord Almighty, will send a wasting disease upon his sturdy warriors. Under his pomp, a fire will be kindled like a blazing flame. The light of Israel will become a fire, their Holy One a flame. The splendor of his forests and fertile fields it will completely destroy, as when a sick man wastes away. And the remaining trees of his forests will be so few, a child could write them down. Isaiah's mixing that previous metaphor, you see, that he used in the case of Israel, the metaphor of fire, with a new image here, an image particularly appropriate to Assyria, of a plague, a wasting disease. So he's describing the collapse of Assyria's pomp and glory, just as a cancer, he says, turns a strong man into mere skin and bones, just as a fire has the power to reduce a thick forest to a handful of scattered and charred tree stumps. So God will soon decimate the Assyrian army. At the end of the day, he says, a five-year-old will be able to count her great warriors on the fingers of one hand. Whether she's willing to accept it or not, the truth is that the God of Jerusalem is no man-made image like all the others. He is the Lord. The Lord Almighty, says Isaiah. And it is a matter of general policy with the Lord Almighty, that he will not tolerate arrogance in human beings. He scatters the proud wherever he finds. The king of Assyria would find, like proud Pharaoh before him, like proud Nebuchadnezzar after him. But God punishes willful pride of heart and a haughty look in the eye. Let me ask you this morning, Do you consider yourself a success? A business success, perhaps? An academic success? A success with the opposite sex, maybe? Or on the sporting field? If so, there's a question Isaiah is asking us this morning. It's a similar question to the one we asked earlier. How do you react? Not this time to the defeats and the failures in your life. How do you react to the successes in your life? Are we tempted, perhaps, like the king of Assyria, to attribute our prosperity to our financial acumen and our commercial enterprise? As one reaches into a nest, so my hand reached for the wealth of nations. Are we inclined, perhaps, like the king of Assyria, to put our honours degrees and our doctoral theses down to our incredible intelligence and hard work? By the strength of my hand I have done this, by my wisdom, because I have understanding. In short, are we possibility thinkers? People who believe in ourselves, who stand in front of the mirror and say, not only I can, I can, I can, but because we are successes, we can say, I did, I did, I did. There are an awful lot of people like that around today, it seems to me. Fully paid up members of our secular humanist society in the 20th century, with their supreme confidence in the unstoppable juggernaut of human progress and their Promethean estimate of man's potential for achievement. Swinburne summed it all up perfectly in a poem in which he sarcastically mimics the song of the Christmas angels. Glory to man in the highest. He is the master of things. And of course, in our case, we can make it a little more personal than that. Glory to me in the highest. I am the master of things. Is that our philosophy? If so, then Isaiah asks us the same question he asked Assyria. Does the axe raise itself above him who swings it? Or the saw boast against him who uses it? Don't you realize, he says, that brilliant brain you're so proud of, the brain that got you here to Cambridge, maybe? It's a gift. A gift of God in creation. Those business opportunities that have made you so prosperous, they are a gift. A gift of God in providence. Those good looks, that athletic body, they're all gifts. We're not self-made men. It is He who made us, not we ourselves. Oh, I know modern man doesn't like to admit that. Everything about our culture encourages self-promotion, self-assertion, self-reliance. Every TV advert pushes the image of the successful man deeper and deeper into our subconscious, isn't it? With his American Express gold card from his pocket. He smokes Old Bruno and he drinks Nescafe Gold Blend and he washes his jeans in the laundrette. But one thing you can be absolutely sure of, he's got plenty of pride. Oh yes, he's the man everybody's looking at. He knows it. He's got self-confidence. It oozes from every pore in his smug, self-satisfied face. He's successful and he knows it. And he makes jolly well sure everybody else knows it too. I will punish the king of Assyria. or the willful pride of his heart and the haughty look in his eyes. For he says, by the strength of my hand, I've done this. Beware of pride. Pride comes before a fall. And there is a better kind of success. There is a better, nobler kind of dignity. There is a higher kind of glory. Do you want to know where you can find it? Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he wrapped a towel around his waist, poured water into a basin, and began to wash his disciples' feet. If ever there was a man who had the right to be proud, it was him. He had come from God, he was going to God, he was God. There was no arrogance in him to make such a claim. He was a greater man than you and I could ever hope to be. So, he humbled himself. Humbled himself to wash his disciples' feet. If I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. Whether, like Assyria, you're one of those people who is fortunate enough to have enjoyed success in life, or whether, like Israel, you come here this morning feeling bowed down by defeat and failure and disappointment, I have a prayer to recommend to you. And I prefer it, I have to say, to that possibility prayer that we began with. I can, I can, I can. I want to suggest that we all, every day, get down on our knees and say like the Apostle Paul, who was once a very proud man himself, by the grace of God, I am what I am. And if ever that prayer starts to stick in our throats, I suggest we remember that day when Jesus washed his disciples' feet and allow him to wash ours. Pride comes before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall. Jesus said, blessed are the meek, they will inherit the earth. Let's pray together.